Well, good morning. This is the Lou Rockwell Show, and what a treat it is to have as our guest this morning, Mr. Eric Margolies. Murray Rothbard always used to complain that all the terrorism experts on television and newspapers all were just spouting the regime's line. They were not actually experts at all. Seems to me it's exactly the same thing with foreign policy experts. They all are, you know, quote-unquote experts rather than actual experts, and they are all spouting the regime line. And it's so great that LRC, this show, and also our daily articles once a week have a wonderful article from Eric Margolies, who's an actual foreign policy expert. I mean, he's somebody who's traveled so extensively, speaks a number of foreign languages, has studied deeply the peoples and countries, economics and culture, and of all the trouble spots in the world, especially in the Middle East and close by areas. And Eric, there are some people who think that Hamas was created in part by foreign intelligence services to compete with the secular Palestinian Liberation Organization. And certainly it's been very convenient for some people. Is the same true of ISIS? I mean, ISIS certainly seems to have revivified Americans' interest in going to war. They're afraid that ISIS is about to take Cleveland. Seems like a brilliant creation of somebody, not to say that these people aren't for real in many senses. But tell me, is that wrong? What are your thoughts about ISIS and what's happening in Iraq right now?
I was there when Hamas began. Its growth was assisted by the Israeli government, by Israel's Mossad, as a way of splitting the Palestinian movement. In fact, it backfired on them very badly. Hezbollah, same thing in Lebanon. Its growth was assisted by the Israeli government until they had a falling out. There's something very weird and strange and not right about ISIS. I watch the events unfold, for example, like the battle that's going on currently for the by nothing town of Ramadi, and nothing looks right. Nothing rings right. I've covered 14 wars in my time as a war correspondent. I've never seen anything like this. It looks more like theater than actual fighting. And I have very strong suspicion, without the proof, that ISIS indeed is a creation of the Western powers, because it's so very useful in keeping the U.S. in war and keeping U.S. forces active in the Middle East.
No, it's true. And I noticed that the Saudi Arabians, I saw reference to an ad they were running yesterday looking for a bunch of more beheaders, because they're executing so many people and they wanted swordsmen capable of cutting people's heads off. No American seems to care about that. But when people's heads are cut off, and of course, it's obviously monstrous and evil to murder people, however you do it, what I think of as a PR gimmick of ISIS has riveted people, not only in the United States, but all over the West. It's been a brilliant success. In fact, I can remember when at one point an Israeli official was asked, who would you rather see out of existence, Assad, strongman of Syria, or ISIS? And he said, we'd much prefer to deal with ISIS. Doesn't it seem that a lot of American arms seem to end up with ISIS? No matter what the U.S. claims that it's doing, it's in fact arming ISIS massively.
Well, ISIS has grabbed a lot of arms from Iraqi government, useless troops. But it's true, arms are finding a way to ISIS. It's part of the civil war that we created in Syria. And there's been a steady flow of arms from the Arab Gulf states like Qatar and the UAE, and aided by Turkey, which has its own murky role in this, to arm ISIS and other extremist groups like the Nusra Front and other crazies running around in Syria. So they're getting arms, they're getting money, and, you know, if we had wanted to wipe out ISIS, we could have, but instead what we're doing is doing this light bombing and formed another of our famous coalitions, and lots of other countries comply at war, like Canada, for example, that claims it's fighting terrorism globally, and it's a cheap, low-cost war, but it wins votes at home by people who are, as you said, frightened.
Well, I find it astounding. I mean, how shall I put this? ISIS doesn't have an air force, doesn't have any ships. I mean, they would have actually no way of getting to the United States, even if they had vast numbers.
That's quite right. But, you know, one of the reasons was some poll studies that were done after President Bush's second term election was that one of the strongest support was in exurbia, right out in the Bible Belt areas and far from the cities, where housewives felt that Osama bin Laden was going to come and get their little Johnnies on the way to soccer practice if we don't keep, unless we elected President Bush to wage crusades abroad. I mean, that's how uninformed people are.
To fight them over there so we wouldn't have to fight them over here.
That's exactly right. ISIS, by the way, appears to have one tank. They keep showing it over and over again. They're one T-55 tank that they captured. And, what's funny is that the Iraqi army, which has been trained at vertiginous expense by the U.S., and armed by the U.S. to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, while our trains are breaking down, we have money to give to Iraq. These are trained soldiers. ISIS people are not trained soldiers. They're scruffy teenagers who have gone off on some kind of modern version of children's crusade. And the only trained fighters in the ISIS camp are veterans of Saddam Hussein's army. The rest of them are just young punks running around with burp guns.
Well, when I think of the Iraqi army, of course, the U.S. destroyed the Iraqi economy as well as Iraqi society with the invasion and occupation. These guys don't have much of an economic opportunity. Seems to me that's why many of them joined the army, just to get the salary. But on the other hand, why should they die for Baghdad? I mean, why if it's really a fight, why shouldn't they head out of town?
You're quite right. The current Iraqi government is regarded as a sock puppet of the Western powers. It commands no loyalty in Iraq. And as you say, they're there because they're being paid. One could also say that about the U.S. Army, too, to an extent. We see over and over again, we see the same problem in Afghanistan. The government commands no loyalty. It has no respect, and it's regarded as an agent of the foreigners. So you're right. Well, who can expect them to fight?
You know, thinking of the U.S. Army on a slightly different topic, it's been a very long time since it actually faced significant troops, poor people with ancient rifles in the mountains of Afghanistan. But I sometimes wonder what actually would happen to the present group of American soldiers if they actually were to face real opposition, let's say the Russians. Seems like the U.S. is just right on the edge of wanting a war with Russia.
Well, yes, you're quite right. And, I've often remarked on this that the American Army, and I speak as an Army veteran, American Army has been trained and configured to fight colonial wars. It's an imperial army, and it's become like the British Army was in the 1880s and 1890s, used to fight tribesmen on the northwest frontier. When the British Army met the German regulars on the Western Front, they were very, very disconcerted. They were really badly beaten initially. The American Army has to go through the same process. It's still configured to fight imperial wars, but there's a consensus in the Pentagon, at least, that the real fight is going to be with China. The U.S. Air Force is configuring itself to fight an air war in the Pacific off the coast of China. It's developing interesting new strategies. But the Army certainly is not. And the Army is still back in the, General Kitchener days. And it has lost its sharp edge in fighting a modern war. As you say, we almost went to war with Russia over Ukraine. It may still happen.
Very interesting what you say of them wanting to target China. Certainly that's the pivot to Asia, and a lot of the trade, the TPP trade treaty, has to do with fighting China. Even I noticed Obama the other day saying the U.S. has to write the rules for trade in that part of the world, otherwise the Chinese might write them. China's an important power. Why shouldn't they have something to say? I remember once hearing Bill Kristol denouncing the Chinese, this is some years ago, a premature Sinophobe, saying that there was a real threat that China sought to be the dominant power in the South China Sea. I mean, it seems to me like they're saying, watch out, the U.S. seeks to be the dominant power in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, that's exactly right. I'm just reading a book by a Chinese strategist named Ming Fen, who called China Dream. And it's about how China is going to become the world's greatest power. It's on the way. And the U.S. has to step back in the theory. This is the author speaking. The U.S. has to step back and accept that China is the big boy in the region, even though China has no desire to conquer or rule other nations. And he said it never has. So that's an interesting thought. I've often written that this is going to be the dominant theme of this century, is if and how the U.S. can accommodate the growth of Chinese power and Indian power without getting into a war.
Jim Rogers points out that many peoples have been great once, whether it's the Romans or the Greeks or the French or whatever, but the Chinese have been great twice. And he thought that in some sense, this is going to be, not in a military sense, but this was culturally and economically going to be, the future was going to be in China. It's why he moved to Singapore to teach his children, so his children would grow up learning how to speak Mandarin, because he thought this was indeed the future from an economic and a cultural standpoint, not from a military standpoint.
Well, I think so. The Chinese make much of their cultural superiority. I mean, in this book that I just mentioned, the author keeps saying how Chinese are the most intelligent people in the world. He said, just look at school test results. And one has to say, yes. And the Chinese have a 5,000-year-old culture, which gives them great moral and intellectual strength. So China looks like it has everything going for it, and this will be the China's century rather than America's century. America's wasted all of its brain power and money on these foolish colonial wars in the Middle East and in Afghanistan, whereas China has been cashing in, getting all the money and buying up resources and influence in countries around the world. So it seems very clear, but there's always one problem lurking in Chinese history, and that is centrifugal forces, as the geopoliticians used to say. And that is that China is so big and it's so complex that it also always runs the risk of starting to fall apart and weaken and getting in regionalism, local wars and things. So this started to happen during the Cultural Revolution of the 1970s. So everything looked great for China, but you can never be sure.
I have a friend who visited China shortly after Mao's death when, for example, Confucianism had been outlawed and we thought wiped out in some sense during Mao's reign. And my friend said all over China, and he traveled extensively, there were very well-kept Confucian cemeteries, Confucian temples. And he said he thought that, as also has been sometimes true in Chinese history, the emperor didn't, his writ didn't necessarily run everywhere and on everything.
The mountains are high and the imperial palace is far away, as the old Chinese saying goes. And it's true. I mean, one could spend your life in China and India as well trying to figure out the country. It's so complicated. God help us trying to do it. We're still trying to find out what happened to Herzegovina from Bosnia-Herzegovina. We have a brain gap in foreign affairs in Washington and across the United States. So we're going to have a lot of trouble wrestling with this problem.
You mentioned India, and the U.S., of course, is doing a lot to try to entice India into a strong alliance with the U.S., but also is afraid of India, afraid of a possible Chinese-Indian alliance in the same sense as a Russian-Chinese alliance. Tell me what you think is happening as far as India and its military power and economic power.
Well, India's power is growing, and it's turning into an important military power. You know, one hears all this these hysterical warnings about Iran's nuclear powers. India has up to 80 nuclear weapons, and India is just deploying now submarines that can fire nuclear-tipped sea-launched missiles, which could stand off Washington and fire them, or India is developing a whole range of intercontinental ballistic missiles. with nuclear weapons. Why does India need a 3,000-4,000-mile range missile, 5,000-mile range on? We're not quite clear. But India has made very clear, since I follow Indian military affairs, that the Indian Ocean belongs to it. And outsiders stay away from our Mare Nostrum. This is interesting because at some point India could come into conflict with the United States. But right now I see no possibility of an Indian-Chinese alliance. In fact, my first book, War at the Top of the World, I postulated that China and India would go to war in the 21st century, and they'd fight over...
And they did have a war in the 20th century, didn't they?
That's right. A brief border war, I think it was 1963, on the eastern end of the what was then Northeast Frontier Agency. But today they have a 2,500-mile border, which, thanks to the British, is very poorly demarcated. The British, who drew the lines, used thick nib pens. I mean, silly as this sounds, and this left a border with questionable areas all along. The eastern border, Arunachal Pradesh, as it's called today, or the Chinese call it South Tibet. And then there's another chunk of land in the west called Aksai Chin, which the Indians claim is part of Kashmir. That's another whole dispute. So it's very complicated. I see lots of tensions between the two. And each one, of course, wants to be the big boy in Asia. And there's no love lost between the Chinese and the Indians.
Eric, you've pointed out in the past the sometimes extreme danger of an atomic war between Pakistan and India, that nobody seems to pay any attention to what that would actually mean for those poor people as well as the world.
That's quite right. I think it's one of the probably the primary danger we're facing, though the current White House and Congress are doing their best to push us into another near-death experience in Ukraine. But India and Pakistan are at scimitars drawn. They have a million men deployed facing each other on the border of Kashmir. They've been arguing about this piece of land since 1947. It's the world's oldest major border dispute. And it's very dangerous because India has developed its conventional forces so highly that they can now overrun Pakistan, even though Pakistan has a big and very capable army of around 400,000 men.
Do you think that's a danger? I mean, of them actually invading Pakistan and...
I do. They've threatened to do it many times. The Indian military is chomping at the bit. It takes about 2 days by tank to cut Pakistan in half, and it's narrow waist portion. So the problem is that India, there's fighting in Kashmir. The Indian army wants to go and teach the PAKs a lesson, as they say. Pakistan knows it can't withstand a full-scale Indian conventional attack, so it's developed a range of tactical nuclear weapons that are designed to hold off the Indians, and that has been an effective policy. But the trouble is they're on a 3-minute early warning alert, and it's terrifying. And the radar system gets a 3-minute alert. This is in countries where the telephones don't work, and they have to call and find somebody. What do we do? Meanwhile, it looks like enemy missiles are on the way. Well, a major nuclear exchange, could kill probably a RAND Corporation estimated about 2 million people initially, but or 100 million people eventually due to illness or radiation poisoning. Just as bad, it could release clouds of radioactive dust that would circle the Earth and fall on our heads.
And also, of course, the radioactive dust in the atmosphere keeping the sun from shining on us and bringing on a very, very cold temperature is bad for agriculture and human life in general. Meanwhile, they're worried about Crimea.
Oh, which should be no worry to anyone. I know. They pay attention to small issues. The U.S. had no interest in Crimea, had no interest in that part of the world. But the minute the Russians moved in, all of a sudden it became a major event. Even the Crimea was predominantly Russian, even when it was ruled by Ukraine, which got Crimea in 1954, Nikita Khrushchev, who was Ukrainian, at a special event dinner, got drunk as usual and gave Crimea to the Ukraine Socialist Republic. In those days, it meant nothing but under the Soviet Union, but now it means a great deal. But anybody who knows that part of the world would know that there was no way that the Russians were going to let the hero city of Sevastopol, of its great port, fall into hands of NATO or the Ukrainians or anybody else. It's like us giving up Houston.
So here we have all these problems, but let's go back just as we finish up, Eric. What's happening with the Palestinians? I guess everybody's forgotten them. They're not really an issue anymore, are they? I mean, or are they an issue? They're certainly not an issue in America, except as hate objects. What about in the Arab world? What about in the broader Muslim world? Or has Bibi Netanyahu settled that problem to his satisfaction?
I'm sorry to say, I think he has. The Palestinians have been totally marginalized, delegitimized, and forgotten. And not only in the West, where they're, as you write, they're held at the hate figure by the pro-Netanyahu media, but they're scorned and ignored by their Arab brothers just as much. You know, the biggest expulsion of Palestinians was done by the Israelis in 1948. The second biggest was done by Kuwait when Arafat came out and backing Saddam Hussein in his dispute with Kuwait. So hundreds of thousands were kicked out of Kuwait. So no, it's hopeless. And the only significant Arab power that's left, Egypt, is now completely in cahoots with Israel and is violently anti-Palestinian. So the only recourse left to the Palestinians is violence to keep their name and their cause in front of the world. Because we know the Israelis hold all the cards. Netanyahu actually defeated President Obama in trying to promote a Palestinian settlement. There never will be a Palestinian state unless it's in the desert somewhere. And the Palestinians, in my view, have absolutely no hope.
And of course, doesn't the Likud party platform say there will never be a Palestinian state?
That's quite right.
Even though we're supposed to hate Hamas for saying they don't want a Jewish state.
And even, you know, it's not just the United States, which is totally dominated by pro-Israel sentiment, but Canada has become even more militant than the Likud party. It's become an extension of Israel's far right. And France has moved very much in that direction, too, not to mention Australia. So the Palestinians have no allies. The Russians even have sort of given them short shrift. The only states that supported them was Syria. That's why there's so much pressure to overthrow President Assad in Syria, because not only will it take away the strongest supporter of the Palestinians, but it also cement Israel's control of the Golan Heights, with the Syrian Golan Heights, which it has quietly annexed.
Well, Eric, thank you for telling us the truth. Thank you for all the work you do. And it's so wonderful, such an honor to have your column at LRC. And we'll, of course, with this podcast, link to your archive, link to your Facebook page, your YouTube channel, and to your two books. Are you working on a new book, by the way?
I am, fitfully, Lou. It's called Camping with Gaddafi and Other Adventures in the Third World.
Oh, yeah. Well, sounds wonderful.
I'm working on it when I get a chance.
Eric, I look forward to it. And thanks so much for coming on. Thanks again for your wonderful perspective. It's great to hear about all these issues from somebody who actually understands and has the experience necessary to evaluate what's going on. Thank you.
Thank you, Lou.
Bye-bye, sir.
Bye.
Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.